Denno, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very much looking forward to our chat. You have an exceptionally interesting background and some really fantastic perspectives on where you see the industry going and the opportunities in that as well. So to start off, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself? You're currently the Managing Director of DAS Studios. Tell us a bit about your journey and DAS.
Yeah, no worries. Well, thanks for having me on. It's always a great experience to share my story. I guess I always should have been an architect, but through high school, found myself ultimately doing some subjects that perhaps didn't align with that best. I went and studied a science degree before I actually found my way to architecture. So I studied nanotechnology before I grew the courage to tell my mum, you know what, I just need to be somewhere where my gregarious nature can come out to its fullest and not a science lab. So I ultimately landed in architecture. And to be honest, I kind of was always busy doing other things just in my life. My life was always very full, be it sport, be it working, an eldest of three boys and a single mum effectively. So I took on a lot of other responsibilities as well. So I was always distracted by other parts of life that weren't just university.
Which is good. And
yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's a key part of the foundations that I built that then unlocked what happened next, right? You know, there's something to be said. I ran a nightclub for a while, so while I was at university. So, you know, I'd be at
the entrepreneurial spirit was already always there, running it for somebody else.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I'd be, you know, and it was on Highley Street right next to where the university was. So, you know, I'd finish at 4 a.m. and then have a quick nap and then roll straight into, you know, lectures at 9 a.m. on the Friday morning. So, but there's something to be said about what you learn from watching people and observing people. You learn a lot and just managing people generally. But got through my architecture degree. My lecturers would say had potential, but wasn't committed. And that's a fair position for them to have taken. But like I said, I was busy learning about all the other things that help support making architecture, not just the buildings. So came out of university 2008. An important part of all this is I also met Sarah Horsman, which is the S in DAS, my wife and partner in everything. Our lives are wholly and fully integrated. We met in 2007 we met, and then 2008 I finished my degree. 2009 walked straight out into a GFC climate, so it wasn't really much going in terms of work. And so, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit, just started doing work for builders, doing visualizations and renders and whatever I could.
Wow.
About six months into that, kind of got a bit fed up of chasing getting paid, so decided I need a more permanent fixed income salary kind of arrangement, and just did some banging on doors and ultimately led me to a small practice in the southern suburbs of Adelaide. And whilst it wasn't the best representation of what I guess I thought architecture was as a professional kind of career path, it did give me 18 months of time with, you know, you talk about these really key people in your life and across your career as well. I basically got to sit next to someone who had been working in the profession for 40 years, was a, you know, very experienced practitioner, but had, as an experienced practitioner, made the transition to the CAD, you know, CAD and documentation software. So I was very lucky that I got this sort of 18-month one-on-one mentorship around how buildings actually come together. So I think that was a really important part of wiring my brain to enable good architecture. But yeah, 18 months in, kind of got to a tipping point where I needed to spread my wings a bit more and actually experience more of what architecture would look like. And that ultimately led me to an opportunity with another small practice who at the time were doing a lot of award-winning residential work. And that was with Dimity Anderson Architects. Dimity had actually been a tutor of mine at university, and Sarah had actually started working for her in her capacity as, I guess, a design assistant more than anything else, because Sarah had done the 3-year degree of architecture and then had got into doing a 3-year industrial design degree. So her kind of sweet spot is combining architecture and industrial design. So she's across the broad spectrum of all things design. So I spent a good period of time with Dimity, and on my first day, I went out to a couple of homes, which would both go on to win named awards in the architecture program. And that was a real eye-opening moment for me around, oh, okay, I understand how good this can be. So worked with Dimity and Sarah and a small group of other really talented designers for a period of a couple of years. And Dividi explored the growth trajectory. She wanted to grow, so we expand a little bit and we're broadening out beyond just residential work. Unfortunately, on the tail end of the GFC around, you know, 2011, 2012, we're at now, it just wasn't really taking. And unfortunately, she had to make some tough decisions around what she was doing. And at that point, you know, both Sarah and I were ultimately let go. So that was an interesting time for us. And it's interesting, though, because there's all these sliding door moments. So at that point, I was a bit fed up with architecture, the idea of architecture, and was going to opt out and go do project management or something else completely different. But fortunately, one of Sarah's best friends, Millie Greve Putlin, is the daughter of Steve Greve. And I've known Steve that whole time that Sarah and I were together. And we'd always talk about architecture and the arts and cricket amongst the other things. But the girls conspired for me to have a chat with Steve before I decided to quit architecture. And we went for a coffee chat in 2012, August 2012. And he sort of, I guess he saw something, you know, a spark of sorts. And he said, look, let me go away. I have to have a chat with my partner, which was Paul Gallet. And a week later I got a call saying, yeah, we want you to come and join Greve Gallet. And what's interesting about that is that Greve Gallet, through that process of me being interviewed, also then met with Dimity and then ultimately became Greve Gallet Anderson for a while there. So Sarah and I both ended up this sort of meet in a different practice kind of relationship marriage sort of thing. Yeah. So Greve Gallet Anderson, as it ultimately became, was a really amazing place for me. Across those three directors, Dimity, Paul and Steve, you know, if you could combine them together, they make the one whole kind of perfect architect.
And if somebody isn't familiar with the Adelaide market, I mean, these guys are one of the major firms in Adelaide, aren't they?
We'd call them, like, we have national firms, and then we have what I would call big local firms. So effectively just based in South Australia, anywhere from 30 to 60 staff. And there's probably a handful of those types of practices. So they really key part of that ecosystem. So I joined that team and effectively with those three directors was given the absolute ultimate kind of insight to what it takes to be an architect, not just in terms of designing buildings, but all the things that sit around what architecture actually is, including the commercials, fee submissions, BD, the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah.
But in all of that, I guess I was, you know, a high performer, high achiever and, you know, was a sucker for punishment. A big part of my identity, and it is big part of my identity to this day, is around, you know, my work. And, you know, the benefits of being good at your job means that you get more and more opportunity. And I just gobbled it all up, just took it all on.
Yeah.
To a point where ultimately it broke me, which is a pretty common story, I think, for people that are that way inclined. So, yeah, across 2017, I was working on projects interstate as well as in Adelaide. So I had already full workload here in SA and then was working on projects interstate in JVs. And amongst all that was managing some complex stuff in my family life in terms of my grandmother and managing her estate and things like that, which was a responsibility that was thrust upon me that I wasn't expecting. And ultimately, yeah, one wintry morning in June, flying in from Adelaide to Sydney on the red eye, stood up to talk at a meeting and basically just collapsed. And it was like my brain just said, nah, you're done. We've had enough. And, you know, blue screen of death kind of thing. And over a period of 48 hours really dropped away and fell into what was something I'd never experienced before. I never want to experience again, but this, you know, absolute anxiety and depression, black hole basically. Amongst all that, I mean, I know that sounds all very dire and it was the time.
Well, it just sounds like your body is essentially, it's what we call a burnout. And a breakdown, depends which part you want to work, but it sounds like, you know, enormous amount of stress that you've gone through. There's a few things once you finish the story I want to go back on, because I think there's a few things you've touched on here and we'll get to, which is around, one, you know, when it's a tough market, and there are tough markets on at the moment in different parts of the country, and there might be tough markets ahead, right? Yeah. And I think that's always one of the things for graduates is coming into a tough market. Right. So there's two things that you've said there, because a lot of people can lose and give up hope, but you actually went and sort of hustled a bit around, right? Which is one of the things when we get to your story of actually being the MD of DAS, that is part of the job, right? Like you have to hustle to be able to get work. It's a part of, if you want to do good architecture, you've got to have the opportunities to do that, right? But then you've gone to work for somebody small as well. And I think that's the other thing. Sometimes people always think that they have to have that journey of going to work somewhere big. Some people get that, but fundamentally, there are a lot of opportunities out there where you can work for small firms or sole practitioners. And yet it may not have this grandiose title on your CV, and the projects may not be the sexiest thing in the world, but geez, you're going to learn a lot about architecture because you're going to be working with somebody who's quite seasoned and be going through, and they need the skills that you have that they don't have, which is generally on the tech side. And they've got this plethora of 40 years of mentoring one-on-one that you will hardly, or one on a few that you will not necessarily get by being in a large studio where you might be working on more, you know, I'm talking very large national studios, and it might be more in documentation. So I always think people have a journey throughout, and sometimes, you know, I think there is a really big benefit in working for small practices and even sole traders or sole practitioners, particularly early on if you can't find opportunities. I mean, the industry is full of, you know, 75 to 80% of firms are under 10 people. So you've got to remember when you're coming out, I think the other part of your story I really like is that you hustled with it. You didn't just hustle in that part. That gave you good experience, I'm imagining, and then you went and door knocked. Again, that is a really vital skill to learn when you're actually going to become a director, or you're going on to lead a practice, is the ability to find people's details and put yourself out there. It can be hard, and taking rejection is a really, really tough thing. But again, I'm sure it's an approach like you have to when you BD. It's a bit of a numbers game as well. And once you kind of put that into your head versus taking it on a personal nature, it helps. So I think it's a really, really interesting story and a great thing for aspiring architects or people coming, graduates coming in, that think that it all has to be one way when it really doesn't have to. Yeah. Everybody has a different journey, and look where you've got. So you did all that. You've had you know, a bit of a mental health episode, and then essentially that's pulled you to a bit of a grinding stop. And so tell us from there.
Yeah, so interesting. I mean, a wake-up call. To that point, I guess, I just felt pretty bulletproof, right? So a real wake-up call around, you know, the fragility of life, all things considered. So, yeah, I mean, and the team, they were great. They did what they could to help me come good, and the family was an importantly valuable part of that equation as well. But, you know, surprisingly, I came good relatively quickly, and still carried the scars of all that, and still do to this day, but came good to the point where within, you know, a few months, it was back to some sort of version of business as usual. And in 2017, Sarah, at this point, was working in another similar large local practice, and the two of us were very much on the pathway to directorships of those practices, to the point where at Greaveville Anderson, that was, you know, 12 months later, the major inflection point of my entire career was around opting in to becoming a director and buying in to becoming a director, or choosing to do something different. And ultimately, it was Sarah who made that call. Ultimately, she was the one that made that decision that, you know what, she wants to do her own thing, and she actually started DAS. So I'm not the founding person of DAS. It was 100% Sarah. So she did that at the start of 2018. And over the course of 2018, I guess we were going through that negotiation process around what does actually buying into Greaveville Anderson, as it was then, look like. Get to the end of 2018, and there was just some signs of things that didn't quite line up for me, and some of those symptoms were starting to reemerge. And so basically the family, having seen what happened to me 12 months earlier, and some of my close friends, they basically held an intervention of sorts and sort of said, look, what is it that you want to be able to do? And to be honest, I think the main thing for me is I've always provided for everyone. I always support everyone else. So just knowing that that would be reciprocated was enough. And I just sort of said, I want the opportunity to be able to stop without feeling like the world would end. And they sort of said, look, well, let's just take away that financial responsibility that you might have. Take that out of the equation. What do you want to do? And I said, I just want to stop. And so basically they said, yes, you can do that. It's fine. They gave me permission to stop. And that's ultimately what I decided to do. And so, yeah, resigned in February of 2019, walked away from the director opportunity. That, I mean, it's not really for this forum, but I learned a lot from that experience around leaving a practice in that kind of moment of my career. Something that I have taken with me in terms of how I manage my people and work with my people in DAS Studio as well. And basically, then had this period of time just working with Sarah from the front room of our house in Parkside here in Adelaide, designing homes for people, which was a very big step backwards from where I was and what was going on. But incredibly, with that weight lifted, it just unlocked everything that happened since, which is probably a good time for you to ask me the question for the next part of the story, I reckon.
Yeah, because I was going to say, so essentially the DAS is Dino and Sarah, is that right?
Yes, that's quite lame. Sarah came up with that over a sake in a Japanese restaurant in Sydney when we were doing some therapy, because we both were working in Sydney and kind of had a love-hate relationship with it. So we decided we need to go enjoy Sydney in a way that wasn't just the drive from the airport to the office.
Oh, good. Well, I must say, I absolutely love Sydney and I love going into Sydney. My partner refuses to live there because they've lived there before. And I am like, oh, well, but, you know, we live near the beach and don't need quite as much money to live that close. But look, I mean, it's a fantastic place and I love the way you've come up over that, over a bit of sake. So essentially then you've started the practice, you've done all of that. Obviously, I just sort of made a few comments just closing out on a little bit of your journey. What's your sort of tips to people you've gone through that I've made my comments to when people are thinking graduates coming out? I mean, we're about to start the journey of you starting a business and that becoming a successful business, which is another journey on itself completely. Tell us a bit about that journey when, you know, because a lot of people haven't seen a downturn for a while. The GFC, we're meant to have one every sort of generally about 10 years. It becomes every 8 to 12. And obviously COVID kind of was, everybody had a heart attack, but there was so much investment that we didn't see that. Whereas now we're sort of seeing the slowings in different states. You know, some states are actually and territories are really busy, others aren't. But I think it's a story about the market in general. And if you do want to get into architecture, I think people have had a really good go for so long. There's a lot of people in the industry who haven't seen the other side of it.
What I would say to aspiring graduates, which is something that we take with us in terms of qualities we want to see when we are hiring, we've only just recently hired a couple of graduates after having not for 5 or 6 years. But the thing that I would say is active participation. So what I mean by that is actively engage yourself within the community of architecture. And that starts with SONA, if you're a student at university. It then extends to being part of Imagine and actually engaging with what architecture is, go to events and go and understand all these different things that are happening and understand, particularly in the South Australian context, the marketplace is so small. And, you know, we have our line around, you know, 6 degrees of separation. Genuinely, it's more like 2, if that, here in SA. And it's a bit of our superpower, particularly as the economy is starting to really to rock and roll in a way that I've never experienced in my professional life here in SA. So actively participate and embrace the idea of, as a graduate, demonstrating how you can be helpful to a practice in those early moments. And to be honest, the best way to be helpful is being able to use software in a way that's productive, like Revit, and just take it on the chin, or Revit or ARCHICAD or whatever else might be, and just want to contribute, basically. Don't have expectations of grandiose miracle designing, conceptual ideas and things like that. That may, and if you have that ability, that will come in due course, but you need to let that opportunity present itself rather than force it or expect it just to be handed to you. So being helpful is a really key part of what your first job looks like.
Yeah.
And when we interview people and want to understand about them, we ask more about who and what it is that makes them who they are, what makes them passionate. Have they got a track record of being generous with their time and being giving in their nature? Because those are the sorts of traits that ultimately work well within our environment. Yeah. And once you're in this place of DAS, we actively encourage you to participate as much as possible with the wider ecosystem, and not just within the architecture circles too, because talking in an echo chamber is also not productive. And so actively engaging with things like the property council or the Urban Design Institute or whatever it might be, understand that whole ecosystem.
And it's so important too to go to events, because as you go further through your career, that's going to be part of it. Building relationships and maintaining relationships is a fundamental part. In different businesses, there's different ways of doing it, but in the property industry, that is the way. And a lot of it is because the cost of the projects or the fees are so high. Those aren't just awarded to somebody who has the pretty Instagram. They're awarded to the people that people know that they can trust and they do good work and they've got a point of difference. And we'll go into that. So I think that's a great segue into, you've started to talk a little bit about DAS and how you operate. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what DAS is today and who you assist and what you specialize in?
Yeah, so I guess the first version of DAS, when it was just Sarah and myself, was very much going to be geared around us just having life balance. So doing houses together was the plan, and that's definitely how we started. But I think an important segue to understand where we are now is to actually go back to what has kind of been our unique point of difference, and that's around modern methods of construction, smart construction. So what I was very lucky, again, as I've mentioned a few times, I had some incredible mentors, but to that point of like, being actively engaged, the mentors saw that trait in me and then were willing to invest some time and effort in me in a way that I guarantee was shared with them in their growth as well. So there's something about that, like being generous. Like I now spend time mentoring graduates or students. Anyone that reaches out to me with a compelling enough story, I'll make time for them to give them a leg up, because it's a very much a case of paying it forward. So I was lucky enough that one of my clients was Andrea Dale and John Hill back in 2013-14. And John at that time was the local member for the seat of Ghana in the southern suburbs of Adelaide. We've just had our election, of course, here, and that seat continues to be a Labor stronghold. John was also a senior cabinet minister as well. So I was very lucky, while we were designing his home and constructing his home, I got to spend a fortnight with him. Every once a fortnight I spent time with him on site, and he was very accommodating in the sense that he would, you know, would get through all the site stuff for in half an hour very quickly, and then he'd give me half an hour of his time just to talk about, you know, what was happening in South Australia. And at this particular point in time, both South Australia and Victoria were and have been manufacturing powerhouses of the country, and of course we had both Mitsubishi and Holden based here. We were right in the throes of Mitsubishi's exodus from South Australia, and Holden not far behind that. And Mitsubishi's based at Tonsley was in John's electorate. But it wasn't just about Mitsubishi, it was the entire manufacturing supply chain that sat around supporting Mitsubishi, a lot of which was in his electorate.
Yeah, so for people who may not be aware what that means, you know, it's the parts that go into it as well, you know, whether it's some...
It's the headlights, it's the seatbelts, it's... It's the machining, the tooling, it's all those different things that go into making the components of the car.
And so we're talking about hundreds of businesses and thousands, nearly millions of jobs where people have been skilled in one particular thing. Yeah.
For a long, long period of time. So, you know, through one of these conversations, you know, a cold, wet, wintry day, John was talking about this current issue and talking about this, I guess, vacuum of opportunity that was going to exist for all these people who have been particularly skilled, highly skilled in one thing with no real room to pivot. And, you know, we're on the site, it's half built, timber getting exposed to weather, wind, dust, mud, you name it, no trades because, of course, the weather conditions didn't allow them to work. And in that moment I said to him, well, why don't we build homes like we build cars? And he smiled as only he can and said, don't know, but maybe we should. And so for me, in that moment, with someone of his gravitas to sort of add credence to this idea that just came off the cuff for me, then sparked, you know, my whole calling in my professional career. So, and he then has continued to be a mentor. He was part of our founding board for DAS as well. So John, and he's a vice chancellor and other things at one of the universities, and I bump into him around town and, you know, tell that story, and he gets very embarrassed by it. But from that point, my interest in, you know, manufacturing modular prefab, it really peaked, and it became apparent very quickly that whilst there was really great examples of that and sophisticated, mature versions of that around the world, it didn't really exist beyond what we know or had known as prefab and modular, being mining huts and dongas and old 50s, 60s school buildings and things like that. So fortunately enough, the Australian Institute of Architects here in South Australia had the great responsibility of administering a fellowship that was left behind by Jack Hobbs McConnell. Jack Hobbs McConnell was from New South Wales originally, but joined Hassell when it was like in 1925, when it was like just Hassell, basically. Yeah. So I think he was the second person that joined that team and designed some of our great buildings, a great modernist architect. And effectively, I guess, different time architects made enough money they could leave behind bequests for the future generations. But effectively, I think there's now somewhere maybe 20 recipients of this fellowship. So $15,000 every year is awarded to a student of either Adelaide University or the University of South Australia, which of course is now just one university, to go and research something around the world that they don't have access to here in South Australia. And so, yeah, I applied twice. The important thing is that you don't always win the first time. It doesn't always happen that way. So pick yourself up and go again. Take that emotion side about it, because you get disappointed, but then actually do a deep dive and understand where did you miss the mark and really tailor the next go around what was missing. And was awarded the fellowship in 2014, which allowed me to travel to Asia and to Europe and spend a lot of time backwards and forwards in Melbourne in particular, where the market around prefab modular was really starting to emerge. You had people like Modscape and ArchKit and others, as well as Hickory, who were really starting to do some interesting things. So that that experience really launched a few things for me. One, that prefab modular had to be part of what the future looks like, especially understanding then that we've got these shifting demographics, skill base in the whole country here falling away, challenges around immigration and, you know, enabling people to come in who have those skill trades. It's just, you know, quagmire. We don't have enough homes to house people to build the homes that we need to build, and just this whole thing. So it's a real, real tricky time. And, you know, we've seen a move away from people being incentivized to do trades as well. The old idea was go to university and get a high paying job out of a degree, but don't do a trade because that wasn't sexy.
I have a feeling it will change in the next 20 years. With the
it is now in South Australia. So, you know, credit to the government here that we have technical colleges now that have come back and other things like that, and TAFE being free and the like as a way to really supercharge everything.
We'll definitely come back because I want you to finish this story about how you've got and how you've built DAS today. But definitely in regards to the opportunities and the challenges ahead, I think modular is a very big conversation that we need to have in that. So continue on with your story.
No, it's okay. So came back from the fellowship and decided that we needed to find a way to demonstrate how good modular could be, because that was the fundamental issue here, is that there was this preconceived idea that it was cheap and low quality. And I got together with a good friend of mine who was working in a construction company at the time and said, like, there's something in this. We just have to find the right first foray in that was something that was scalable but also small enough that we could self-fund it. So we worked out that there in South Australia, there was a big hole in the tourism sector, particularly around regional tourism. And so we went about developing effectively a 5-star off-grid hotel room. So this is right before the tiny home movement really took off. And so to demonstrate how good modular could be, we developed a whole tourism business model, which was around the land lease agreement with either wineries or vineyards or the state government around national parks and things like that. And effectively, you know, created a decentralized hotel brand, effectively. And so we self-funded our first project, which was down in McLaren Vale. And that was really important because it was, you know, it's a sexy black box, this building. It looked really good. It was Instagrammed a lot. It was featured in magazines and the paper. And so it started to build that awareness around what was possible. So what I want to do now is, and that was in 2016-17 that we self-funded that. We did a couple of cap raises, grew the business, and then COVID smacked us right in the face just as we're about to expand the business with another 20 or 30 different buildings around a number of sites around South Australia. So we ended up divesting that business, which is an interesting part of my whole experience too. But if I now jump forward to when I finished at GGA and started DAS, I had time again to think and to speculate about big ideas. And so having delivered those first projects, those ESCA projects, ESCA was the name of the venture, immediately my mind turned to the different applications for those ideas, and health and education were front of mind. And so helped contribute to a paper with someone that I met on my all my travels and talking at conferences from Melbourne, which ultimately led to what became a modular schools program for the state government. And then also developed a white paper of sorts called Agile Health Infrastructure, which ultimately made its way to the Royal Flying Doctor Service, which then led to our first pilot project in the health space. So to deliver these other ventures, because ESCA was a standalone tourism brand, we created MDLR as another venture, which then was effectively like a development management business to get these pilot projects off the ground for other ventures. And, you know, there's all these threads that come back together, but ultimately that project for the Royal Flying Doctor Service, because we couldn't find a modular builder that wanted to do the building construction methodology the way that we wanted, we ultimately said, well, stuff it, let's just go rent a big shed. And then we can tender to builders that are traditional builders that have shown an interest in doing this kind of work. Let's remove some barriers for them. And we did that. And, you know, that shed was at Lonsdale. That was in the southern suburbs. It was in John Hill's electorate. It was where they used to build seatbelts, basically, for the Mitsubishi. So there's all these things that kept popping up again around this manufacturing narrative. So, yeah, so we get to this period. We've written these papers. We've got these pilot projects. And by September 2019, we'd already hired a couple of people, which was interesting in itself that, you know, that's already pretty quick growth. We moved out of the front of our house. We only have had one employee had to come and hang out in our house.
Just to get this, the modular and the tourism was sort of still running at this point, and then you sort of started this into more of the medical because we're obviously just before COVID hitting. Okay.
Yeah, yep.
Cool. 100%. That's going to be interesting.
And so, I mean, I guess, you know, we'll cycle back to this, but I suppose one of the key things that's been important about, I guess, why I am who I am, where the business is at, where it is this idea of investing in looking ahead and understanding, like reading the tea leaves, which, you know, are reading policy papers, are being boring and, you know, doing lots of research online around where trends are heading and what our futures potentially look like, you know, scenarios planning, and doing that work, not knowing what will manifest, but being ready to pivot when those stars align. And I think a big part of our journey has been that we've been preparing in advance, and then these things just do come to fruition and we're ready to rock and roll. And we've got a proof of concept that sits behind it so that we're a compelling proposition for a client or a government that wants to do something different.
Yeah.
So the modular schools program effectively came about on the back of a business case that was prepared by this Victorian consulting firm and that we helped contribute to. And it led to a pilot project. Why I talk about the stars aligning, the state government at the time were embarking in the year 7 transition from primary school to high school. So the biggest, most sort of wide reaching touch of school infrastructure across 2018 to 2022. And with those come the challenges of delivery and needing to pull all the levers. Our business case managed to make its way to a point where they said, the state government, Department of Education said, well, let's try this as a pilot project. So we secured a $5 million pilot project for the state government. And we were pumped. We were like, how good's that? We're legit. What transpired over the next month was a visit to Melbourne with a whole range of other principals from other schools in South Australia, and ultimately a program of works that went from our single project to 12 in the space of a month, at a total value of $50 million. So lots of, from $2 million but to predominantly to $5 million new education buildings. Yeah. And we weren't really up for doing all that work because we were four people at that point in time and it all needed to be delivered in parallel. But it became became evident pretty quickly that the government and that particular consultant only really wanted to work with us because we had that head start and we understood what was required. It would have been really difficult to bring new consultants up to speed on what the whole thing was about. So we'd kind of been doing our training in advance basically to understand how it could work. And so, we agreed to it. We managed to secure fairly favorable payment terms because in SA, we had to take on all the responsibility of all the sub-consultants. And across a program like that, we had 30 or so different sub-consultants, multiple engineers across disciplines, landscape architects, you name it.
Yeah.
And so it meant that we weren't cash flowing the whole thing for the government, which is important because we had to embark on growing the firm. So we, from September 20, 2019 to March 2020 grew from 4 people to 16 people in a very, very short period of time.
That's a big change, isn't it? But like you'd already worked a little bit. Big firms, so you kind of were used to what that sort of looks like.
Yeah. When we worked out, when Sarah and I mean, remember, it was a weekend. We happened to go away down to Kaipo for the weekend, and we had a long sort of D&M over the whole weekend about, you know, do we do this or not? And I made this spreadsheet which sort of showed how we could do it and the sequence of, you know, when we'd have to bring staff on and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, two good points.
And we sort of said, okay, let's do it, stuff it. So that's what we did and just went about this process of hiring people. And I guess that body of work that I've been doing engaged in the profession for over a decade meant that there was a credibility piece that sat behind what we're about to do. And so finding people who were interested in that idea of being part of a different version of what practice could look like, because the runs were on the board, meant that we were able to group, like, bring in incredible people to the business who are still with us now, in a period where not only were we delivering this work in a way that hadn't really been done before in a whole ecosystem that never built buildings like this before, but we're actually growing our practice and what our systems were and our processes and all that kind of stuff. So when we realized we had to grow, the first person that we hired was Sarah Thompson. So we have like 3 Sarahs that work in our firm. So everyone has nicknames. So Sarah is Sarah. Sarah Thompson is Tomo, and says whose birthday is today. That's Sarah Thompson as well. She married someone whose surname was Thompson. So we've got 2 Sarah Thompsons and a Sarah Horseman. It's just chaos.
Double A, was at a birthday party. It was like 4 cakes the other day. You certainly know the generation, don't you?
It's a common name. That's right. So Sarah Thompson joined us, and that was instrumental because she helped take care of the business side of things, predominantly with me, establishing, you know, QA systems and all that kind of stuff. And we'd known Sarah for 7 years because she'd previously worked at firms that we'd worked at as well. So we're very lucky in that regard. But yeah, we, you know, every week or every fortnight, there was a new person that would start. Interestingly, the more senior people that joined us at the time were the ones that didn't ultimately work out. I think there's something interesting in that for us around, you know, people being hardwired in their way of doing things and wanting to be a bit more flexible. Didn't quite work for a number of different reasons, but yeah, we've got people that joined us over that period of time that are still with us now, and it's a pretty special period for us. So,
and today you sit about 20, and as you said, you continue to grow.
Yeah.
And you're also
at our peak. We got to 24 at our peak, and we've kind of stabilized around 20 people now. Yeah.
Yeah, and you also have people in Melbourne as well that you joined.
So they're
2
original DAS people. They're original people that joined us in 2019, 2020. They were graduates at the time because we had COVID amongst all that too, right? So we moved into our office space, the space that I'm in right now, and a week later it was all the lockdowns. And so basically we're trying to grow a team, develop systems, deliver these projects, and then we had everyone going home for a little bit. That said, our office did become a bit of a nightclub on Friday nights for a while there because we weren't allowed to go out and do anything. So it was really formative bonding time for the whole team. It was great. That experience.
Well, you're
from,
lucky
you know,
you're not in Victoria where that wasn't possible for quite a while. So those of us who are Victorians, we definitely. But I mean, it is. So trying to do all of that stuff, but you know, it is a period in time. Obviously, you've moved forward. So now what you're doing is you obviously from that you. Then with the MDR, I don't know if that's where you've gone, the construction, but I know you mentioned you've been doing a lot of remote work as well. And I think this is where this opens up. So do you want to tell us a bit about the typology of the work that you're currently working on and the size and scale? Because you're working on quite a large number of large projects and the way you've also gone about that as well.
Yeah, no worries. So that education body of work that we did on that pilot program, as well as the demonstrator projects around health, have ultimately led to sort of 5 to 10 times multiplier projects. So from that project for the Royal Flying Doctor Service in Maree, that then, you know, because we had our facility, we had the building completely put together in a shed basically, and we opened it up for 48 hours and let industry come and see what we had done before we pulled it apart and drove it up to Maree, 800 k's north of Adelaide. An Aboriginal corporation from Ceduna, which is 800 k's west of Adelaide, they drove all the way down to see this building on the back of a mentor of mine saying, hey, you should go check out this building. That led to a project for Yadu Health, which was, you know, that $3 million Māori RFDS project became an $18 million project. This Aboriginal corporation in Ceduna, which is under construction right now. But big part of that is that we helped these organizations secure the funding as well. So we actively participate in growing our opportunities. So we haven't won our big projects really on tenders in competitive market kind of conditions. We've identified our point of difference, helped them grow the opportunity, and then have embedded ourselves in their team to deliver these undertakings. So the Yadu project was very important, and I'll keep going on that health stream. So then we've ended up finding ourselves partnering with a lot of Aboriginal health organisations all around the country, as well as an amazing organisation called Purple House. And effectively, what, you know, that going all the way back to that paper that I wrote back in 2019, the idea of how modular prefab MMC can really become a valuable proposition for remote and rural health to overcome the tyranny of distance and all the logistical issues that come with building in the middle of nowhere effectively.
Well, do you want to talk about some of those for people who aren't aware? Because a lot of people may not actually, I'm fortunate enough, my partner's lived in quite remote. The challenges that you have within that is obviously around skills, getting materials to places, having that. Do you want to talk about some of the challenges that some of your clients in remote spaces deal with?
Yeah, I mean, dollar for dollar, if you built something in an urban center compared to a regional area, you're talking about paying anywhere from 50 to 100% more just by virtue of the inefficiency of all the things that you've just mentioned. And, you know, we just saw on one of our recent projects, you know, a $35,000 variation for petrol to get the buildings out to the lands because of the current issue we're facing around petrol. So what that means is...
They're paying a lot here. They're paying literally double what they are in remote spaces.
100%. So, you know, if you are having to send trades to work on a building because those trades don't exist in a town of 30 people or a community of 30 people, whatever it might be, you're having to accommodate them for that period. You're having to feed them, all those sorts of things. So that's effectively a penalty that goes to the project cost. So these clients in regional and remote areas are not getting the same value for money. And, you know, we're very much about using our skills to create equity in, you know, for all Australians. So the benefit of prefabrication means that we're embedding more of the spend by building more of the building in an urban centre where those issues are removed effectively. And so when we talk about a spectrum of construction methodologies, we're talking about all the way from what we would call volumetric, so boxes that are effectively already all complete that get disassembled and then put back together again on site. So somewhere in the order of 85 to 90% complete before you get out to the location. Then you've got, a hybrid approach, which combines some of that with where it's appropriate using local trades, like, you know, where it'd be, there's a bricklayer, great. So let's do this amount of it prefabricated and let's use the local supply chain for that component. Then there's a kit of parts approach, which is very much around, and what I see is what the future actually looks like in this regard, and that's around panelized, flat pack, modular assemblies and things like that. It's what we use for our largest project to date, which I'll touch on in a second, in the education space. So all these different elements come into our thinking when we design buildings. We don't ram it down a client's throat. We don't force on anyone, but we just say that we've got this broad expertise that's available so that we can make the best for project decision and get the best value for money based on all these circumstantial, situational kind of inputs that shape a successful outcome. And so invariably we're finding that volumetric approach has been really successful for working with remote communities to deliver important health infrastructure, namely renal dialysis clinics, as well as the accommodation for the nurses that stay up there to look after them. So I think at any one point we're doing 10 different clinics around the country, and we're talking about in the Pilbara, we're talking about the Simpson Desert, we're talking about Batu Island in the Torres Strait. So that's a really important body of work that we do in the education
space.
Are
you building that through your MDLR?
No, so MDLR existed for a period of time in a way that enabled us to do these demonstrator projects. And then ultimately there was a tipping point where, you know, our investors and business partners and that were all weighing up where to go from here. My original founding partner, that he really wanted to turn it into a contractor and actually become a builder. The rest of the funders weren't really interested in that idea. And to be honest, if we did do that, for me personally, it would have compromised my ability to exist within the broader ecosystem. I can't be a director of an architecture practice and the director of a construction company as well. So ultimately, the decision was made to wrap that up And Ryan found his way ultimately to a traditional builder who's taken the leap into really specializing in modular and prefab. That's a national company in Shape. And it's been great that we've then been able to continue doing that work together, but also that we've seen here in South Australia that it's not necessarily prefab builders that have taken the step. It's actually traditional builders and large, you know, tier two builders that have said, no, we see prefab modular kit of parts, MMC, as part of the future and are investing in that. And they've been instrumental in us showing that it's not just boxes. Absolutely. It can actually be a whole different approach to building buildings. And that ultimately leads us to our biggest endeavor today, which is a nice, neat little bow on the whole arc from that first conversation with John Hill talking about Mitsubishi. So the Tonsley precinct, the suburb of Tonsley and the Tonsley Innovation District as it is now, was the home of Mitsubishi Manufacturing. And so what was an amazing experience for us is that, you know, connecting that thread back to John and how that whole precinct converted from, you know, where they had production lines for building cars into a thriving industry, education and residential now as well, hub. It's held up as an exemplar around the world. In 2021, we were invited by Flinders University as a wild card to submit for this pilot endeavor they were working on called the Factory of the Future. At the time, it was only a $6 million project. So we went up against, you know, Woodsbagot, GHD, Cox, these types of firms, and just continued to make a compelling enough case around the idea that this was the project we'd been working on for 7 years. We just didn't know it yet, to the point where they said they had to choose us. We were lucky enough to partner with WSP on that, who were the incumbent services and structural engineer for the whole precinct. So we made the case that, yes, whilst we may not have as DAS experience doing large projects, we'll offset that by having WSP as our key strategic partner to remove some of that concern. And, you know, I've heard John Wardle talk about this before as well. This idea that, you know, you need project champions to really get amazing outcomes. And we've been very lucky on all these endeavors that we've had a project champion on the inside that's helped fight for us. And so we secured the project when it was a $6 million pilot. We helped them to get further funding from the state, which grew it to a $20 million project. And then again, the stars lined up such that we had two elections in 2022. And the state election in 2022 that the Malinauskas government won, one of the key policy ideas that he took to that election was the idea of developing technical colleges again. And one of them was earmarked for Tonsley. And so a conversation sparked up around the idea of actually combining this Flinders project together with this state government technical college. And so we helped show how that could happen to the point where we ultimately wrote the brief for the project, including the governance procedures, including the procurement methodology. So we create an environment for our MMC smart construction idea to thrive, to the point where we had Sarah Constructions, who had been a partner with us on a lot of those pilot projects to date, come on board at only 5 to 10% conceptual design and allowed us to make the case for why this project needed to be an exemplar around the future. And so ultimately led to it being a mass engineered timber building. And it's at the Tons Innovation District, which is, you know, what was the start of the whole conversation with John Hill, you know, more than 10 years before that, around reimagining how we can use manufacturing smarts to build our buildings. So that's a $55 million project. It's now finished. And on the back of that, we now find ourselves working across lots of different sectors, including health, education, but now also in housing. So, yeah, we're now working on three or four $100 million projects.
I think there's two things there that, you know, obviously it's a fantastic story. DAS has been going for, you said, 8 years. So far. And it's a story from where you've always had this underlying passion for something. And I mean, modular is something everybody's talking about, but I think you've obviously worked out how we can actually really good use cases of where it is. I think it's going to be very, very interesting in the next 12 months, 2-3 years. So we knew supply costs went through the roof with COVID, obviously, and being able to get things around. The current economic situation that we're in now, we're recording this on the 1st of April, is obviously, you know, fuel prices have gone through the roof. I had a tradie tell me yesterday that, you know, their costs have gone up 30%. I know other trades like plumbers are talking about their silicon and stuff has gone up like 60%. Mm. So the actual construction costs alone are only going to increase, let alone, as you said, getting something transported is going to be $35,000 difference. Now, these situations will change all the time, okay? But I think in a time where labor is actually very expensive, and the costs of getting things done, you know, I think in 20 years' time will be interesting. My kids, you know, I was told to go and do a law degree and do all those types of things, whereas I'm looking at my kid going, mate, you don't want to do that. You want to go and be a tradie, right? Mm-hmm. And then learn
use your
how
hands.
That's right, and then learn how to run a successful business. That's where my son and my daughter, I have no problem, sorry, I should be a bit careful there. But in essence, I think this is where modular is something everybody's talking about. Now, we had somebody on a prior podcast who said, the thing is with modular is the costs and it's stacking up. So I'm really interested to get your insights into what are the challenges that are actually stopping modular from growing.
Yeah. That comment is 100% accurate. What you have to understand in this whole situation, why we've had success is because we've used the methodology of construction in the right application. So all that remote regional work, there is no alternative, and it just makes sense because of the cost penalty associated with building traditionally.
Yeah.
So we've used our regional remote work as a way of getting going around this concept around what actually modular prefab can look like. They're 100% right in an urban context, it doesn't stack up because right now the whole ecosystem is not sophisticated enough to do one of one pilot demonstrator projects every time. What the sector needs is an acceptance around standardization. And so you need to find, if you want it to stack up, you need to create a certain volume of work with a certain amount of repetition. So government has an important role to play to provide confidence around the volume of building work that's going to happen, and residential is that opportunity right now. We're seeing some of these levers being pulled at a, you know, captain's call level with a premier. I saw a massive change. I think it was 18 months ago. It was only a small thing in a federal budget, but Jim Chalmers mentioned a $50 million MMC fund, and all of a sudden my phone started going off just because people wanted to say, oh, what do we do and how do we leverage this and all that kind of stuff. So it's helped to normalize the idea of MMC as part of the solution.
Sorry, just for my stupidity, what is the MMCC fund?
MMC is just the acronym that people have chosen to use to describe modern methods of construction, basically.
Right, so, okay, sorry.
So that's okay. So okay, MMC.
Yeah.
No, okay. I mean, that's why I end up saying it's prefab, it's modular, it's a spectrum
options. And so what's this fund done and why is everybody now so interested?
To be honest, this is the thing. Lots of these things just get announced and then there's not follow through because it's all well and good for someone at the top to announce it. But if the people who are there to administer it within government do not understand and don't engage with industry properly, it doesn't go anywhere. And so that's what we're seeing a lot of. So there's a big gap between an idea and delivery. And what you need to appreciate is that traditional construction effectively can pass on the fixed costs on a project by project basis to a client. If you want to be a modular builder or someone who provides componentry associated with modular building, you have to set up a large facility. You have to fund that facility 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So unless you get a utilization at a large scale out of that, it will not be cost competitive. And so people think of this idea about building like homes like cars, which we go back to the original story. Cars have a very sophisticated system of using a same chassis on a Volkswagen as they do on an Audi. So there are these opportunities for that level of standardization that exists with something like housing. It is, by its very nature, already very standardized, 2,700 high ceilings and roof pitches and all that kind of stuff. Where it's not translating is around this idea that a car is built 10,000 times the same. And
that's right.
You've got, so unless you get into that kind of volume of housing that's the same or with minor variances, it's just not really going to work. So I think watch this space because there are a couple of people that are starting to get that and they're taking a big leap and setting up the base infrastructure to enable that. they're being backed by large banks who see that this is part of the future. So yeah, watch this space. I think you'll see this idea of panelized wall components and things like that to actually help simplify what the housing space can actually look like. So yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. And I mean, you've seen it in some certain sectors, but obviously when we're talking on the large scale side of things. So this is obviously part of what everybody's having a strategic conversation around. How can we, you know, this is a potential solution to the housing crisis. Now, yep. More high density is another potential yep. solution. But right now you're talking about it more on a residential low rise, low yep. density.
Maybe some medium rise as well, 4 to 6 stories as well.
Yeah, but right.
That fundamentally needs, you know, a rejection of NIMBYism to actually enable densification as part of the solution as well. So, yeah, it's an interesting time. I don't see it as being the solution. It's part of an evolution of way of thinking around the construction sector.
Mm.
And ultimately, architects and designers have a key role to play in this because so much of what enables smart construction, as we tend to call it, is the digital overlay of all that. So that's again, it's a unique selling point for us, is that to enable these modular projects, we have to effectively build a virtual representation of the building to the point that it can be fabricated. So that's our business as usual in terms of what we do with our, you know, BIM software and how we draw things. So architects have a really important role to play in enabling that. And there's an opportunity to grab a hold of it if we're smart enough, I think.
So, do you think that's do you think one of the things is because architects always want to create something, right, that's different and new and right. things like that? Even in your chat before, you sort of said, you know, if I'm not interested in it, that's a bit of a marker for me that, you know, that things aren't going well or this isn't of interest. I wonder whether the innate nature of architects is they don't like to be doing the same thing. So the entire idea of creating something that's, you know, can be essentially copied and manufactured on more mass, it kind of goes against the whole design difference.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, our approach is that there's an opportunity to have both, but I think you're 100% correct that there's a certain amount of ego wrapped up in what architects want to do, and I think there's absolutely a place for that creativity, but I think in these tough times, there's a responsibility that we need to have as designers that every decision, like if we want to be legitimate about sustainability and you know, we need to really be responsible in every decision we make. And, you know, architecture for architecture's sake is not necessarily the best representation of that. There's absolutely a time and a place for it. I think it's part of perpetuating this idea that, you know, that high quality architecture is, you know, for the 1%. And the truth is, like, that is the reality. Like, you know, bespoke homes aren't accessible for the yeah. vast, vast majority of the population. So it is an issue. And I don't think modular or prefab, albeit there's some great examples of that, like with Candor and Archer as practices that and businesses that are trying to do that. But yeah, the desire for full bespoke solutions is always going to drive a key part of the architectural sector, the sexy part, the beautiful part, the bit that we all mm-hmm. aspire to. But 95% of the population either can't afford that or don't need that. And so, you know, we're very pragmatic about our approach. These things, we talk about impact and impact at scale as a practice. And so one of the things that came up for Sarah and I to do, which we saw as a massive learning opportunity, but also an opportunity to have an impact, is that we were approached by the Hickenbotham Group here in South Australia, who are the largest home builder, probably 5 or 6 times over compared to their nearest rival. And they build 2,000 homes approximately a year. And they approached us to work with them to rationalize their 150 different designs, to simplify them down to a standardized range, to work with them in their supply chain to understand what are good selection decisions that we can make that allow for more standardization so they can provide better value to the consumer by yeah. having better buying power because there's less variances. Mm. And then we're also given agency to introduce ideas that we would deliver for, you know, our bespoke one-on-one homes. How do we apply that en masse? And so, yeah, we've done that body of work with them to the point where we're now engaged across all of their portfolio. And the idea is if they build 2,000 homes a year and we can improve them by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, you know, the idea of helping them to make a more approachable version of orientation, because the consumer doesn't really, to be honest, doesn't care or get it. And the cost of a home loan means that there's a real challenge around the upfront cost argument of like, oh, it's going to be better for you in the long run. But it's kind of moot if they can't afford to buy it in the first place. So it's there's a real tension there. And to their credit, they were really keen to find a way to work with us so that they could then deliver as a standard a higher quality building that was, you know, aligned with 7-star ratings that they didn't have to do, because that's been frozen now as well, the transition to upgrading the NCC. So anyway, that's a different version of us working as architects in an impactful way. So yeah, we're open to everything and anything, really. But
and I think that's I think that's what it is. You don't just see design as design that needs to look pretty on a piece of paper. You're looking at design in actually how do we meet, you know, the form. I think this might have been yours or somebody else meant finance over function, or form and finance, actually making things stack up. I think that is one of the things that it's interesting when you talk like that. It makes me think it's like everybody wants their own individual home, right? Like it all needs to look different. But at the end of the day, the most efficient way is actually to create something with very little variations within it. And you think about that when you go and you look at apartment buildings, there's only a certain number of finishes and fixtures that you can pick. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how we all want to make. That's a whole other thing in itself, but it's interesting as the psyche, whereas around the world, I don't see that same. And I think it's because we are very fortunate in this country. But majority of the world has something that looks very similar, and it is only the 1% who get something that's particularly bespoke designed to it because they can afford to actually do that, whereas most people live in something that's quite standardized and for those construction costs themselves. Anyway, we could go down that rabbit hole.
I think a couple of things you said there. I think it never has to be an or thing, like or over anything. Like those things only be considered together to get the best possible outcome. We talk about ourselves as prioritizing the systems that shape the way we live and work, and the building just happens to be part of that. So you need to consider the whole kind of environment around how we live and function. So I think that's a really important part of how we do what we do, really.
Mm. No, and look, I think it's a fantastic point of the story. I mean, so obviously just sort of summarizing there, some of the challenges obviously at the moment are that, you know, is the construction costs that we see across the industry. But there is, as I've said previously, there is with challenges, there is always opportunities. And what you're stating here is that you see the opportunity is for firstly designers to think a little bit more differently, and secondly, for us to consider different construction methodologies. And I think that's one of the things, Australia gets very in Australian. You see people come from overseas and worked overseas and they come here and they go, oh, okay, that's a very primitive way of building. Okay. And that's one of the interesting things. Is that something that you also saw when you were doing your studies and your tours of how Australia does and where that gap is and we can learn from how other people are doing?
Yeah, it's a cultural thing more than anything else. And by that, I don't mean like arts culture. I mean like embedded in the spirit of the population kind of thing. And again, a lot of it's out of circumstance, right? Like the weather conditions in Scandinavian countries don't really allow for building out in the weather all the time. So, you know, those forces drive people to a solution where prefabrication makes the most sense. Unfortunately, as a country increasingly here, I think we don't have enough complexity in our economy. And we generally make a good part of our money by digging things up out of the ground and sending them off to other places to add value. So I think I'm really bullish about what the state government here are trying to do in South Australia, and seeing it as our opportunity to drive what change looks like, particularly through, you know, an energy lens. Energy has kind of been a key thing that the state government here are driving around in leading that transition to more renewable energy approaches. Yes, it has some pain and people will complain about our energy bills being the highest and all that kind of stuff, but there's also, you know, I think it's the right thing to do ultimately.
It's a very changing world at the moment. I think we're in a world where economically we're already in an interesting situation, but obviously with things like AI coming in, everybody talks about AI. It's not just all about AI, right? At the end of the day, but from what I'm picking up, you're also talking about that is essentially as a country, we've made so much money out of mining that we haven't had to drive ourselves for innovation. And mining is going to decrease of the next few decades. And I think as a country where, you know, and sometimes you can talk about that as the political cycle of 3 to 4 years, we can't have the longevity of thinking more lateral. And as you're saying, government might make that decision. People might not be happy with the immediate effects of it, but the long-term effects are actually going to be better for our society. And that's always a difficult thing. The same, you know, the Victorian state government, you know, it's billions of dollars in infrastructure and that's nearly killing the state. But at the same time, they know the long-term is the population is going to need that and the infrastructure has to be there.
Yeah, you're adding 100,000 people every year to the city. So you need to build out that infrastructure.
Yeah, and that. And I think that's that dynamic of sort of thinking in the short term versus the long term. And that's where I'm interested, where you sort of think the next 10 to 20 years is where we are today and how we're practicing versus where you see us being in the next 10 to 20 years and how things will actually operate for designers and for the industry.
Yeah, I think the idea of architecture solely as a consulting profession for me is something that concerns me. I think, you know, coming back to that thing I said before about active participation, our success has come from actively participating in the creation of opportunities and projects for ourselves. And we have a very compelling value proposition now, having the experience of doing that. And so we are finding ways to create our engagement such that we get to participate in the upside of what that looks like as well. And it's a thing that's often, you know, frowned upon. You know, we're taught that it's risky from an insurance perspective through our training as architects. But actually, if we create value, why should we not get to participate in the upside of it as well? So we want to be able to find ways to generate revenue for ourselves that isn't just our hourly contributions to projects. And we want to have a trailing commission basically on the success of what we create. I think that, you know, the things that will fall away to AI will be the low-hanging fruit. And there's markers all through history around what they are. And fundamentally, architects will complain about things like, you know, documentation being outsourced. That's a marker that that's going to be the first thing that goes. So increasingly what we're trying to focus on is how we can contribute to projects, not at a concept stage, but actually in what we call phase zero. It's the bit that exists before the idea is actually fully formed, and how do we shape it and drive what it looks like. And so that's where we're going to put a lot of our attention in terms of, like, if you accept that AI is going to have a key role in actually shaping what a lot of our output is as designers. The key thing that we will help shape is what are the inputs that will inform what that outcome actually is. So having that human interface will be a key part of what we do as well. So one of our grads that joined us in 2019, Shannon, she actually won the Jack Hobbs McConnell Travelling Fellowship last year, which, you know, this is the one that I won 10 years ago. And so it's been a very special thing for me to help support her in what she's interested in. And effectively, she's just spent the last 12 months traveling the world, researching the future of practice as well. And so it's really exciting now to think about, as she synthesizes all those findings, to start to put some energy into, okay, well, what does the evolution of DAS look like? And it may not just be DAS, it could be a whole range of other things that spin off out of that work that she's been doing and all of my big crazy ideas.
Well, and it might be, but as you said, if you don't speculate where things are going, I think if you think the way that we're practicing today is the way that it'll be practicing 10 years' time, you've got your head in the sand.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree.
And it's interesting talking to people because I'm surprised by you would be in the 1% of people who are thinking and might sort of realise but don't fully realise yet where this potentially is going. And I think we talk about this value that architects are providing and what can be done. And that definitely is there, you know, that critical thinking and things like that, but in that part. But essentially it's problem solving and finding the best outcome. We are designing buildings. You're designing places that have an impact on people. And the thing that's stopping that is obviously how the costs of things being built. And that was one of the things that we talked with Kevin about from Co-Architecture, is that a lot of architects are thinking very much on design versus thinking, well, actually, how do we get things built? And you seem to be one of the very few architects who use that's the part. How do we actually make it happen? And where is it actually working? I would be very interested by the outcomes of what your team member has actually found within that. And I think it will evolve quite quickly. And I think it's a very interesting time. And for firms like yourself that are, you know, I'll put you in the emerging, as in you've got 8 years, you know, there are firms out there have been around for 30 years. This is something that's fundamental for leaders to be starting to think like. And it's fundamental for every business to be thinking, because the change is happening a lot rapidly than it's ever happened before. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think what I would say is that there's been moments, I touched on this when we had our pre-chat, but just the idea that like my KPI for knowing when I'm well, you know, talking back to mental health and well-being and things like that, is when I'm actively wanting to learn new things. So if I'm up and about and positive, it's when I'm speculating on the future. And so, you know, I find ways to commit time to that. And it's part of the culture that we've embedded here at DAS as well, that we make space for people to want to do that. In terms of speculating around what the architecture profession looks like, I think, you know, we're looking ahead to, we've had times where I've been distracted in delivery mode. Like, you know, it's all well and good to have all these big ideas, but you need to focus on delivery amongst all this as well. And I suppose you need to be always, it just needs to be omnipresent. You need to be thinking about these things all the time, because if you create a hole, it manifests down the line as a bit of a gap. And I suppose as we were working through completing our most recent big project, the Tonsley Technical College and Factory of the Future, I had an expectation that was going to result in opportunities just naturally coming, because, you know, we're legit now, we can do big things, everyone will get it. But the reality is South Australia, albeit that it is becoming more progressive, is still a very conservative market. And so we found ourselves competing in a more traditional way in open, well, not open tenders, but select tenders and lots of runner-ups, losing to the incumbent kind of business as usual practices. And so, you know, a big part of our strategy in thinking further ahead around what we want to do has been around this idea that, well, we need to find a way that, you know, modular prefab as an idea helped us leapfrog into opportunities. We want to continue to have an impact and do bigger and bigger work. To do that, we needed to jump ahead of our contemporaries here in Adelaide. And so JVs has been a key pivot in our strategy in the last 9 to 12 months. Once it became apparent that going and competing in it wasn't a fair fight in a select tender kind of arrangement. I did a roadshow, traveled around Melbourne a couple of times, met with lots of different practices and talked about, you know, told my story and outlined the opportunity that exists in South Australia, selling the case for South Australia, but ways in which my skills could apply in a national context as well. And that's ultimately led to JV opportunities, but then some that have actually turned into real projects. So we're working on a project with Wardle at the moment, which is exciting, on a project that's at a scale that we've never done before, but they've helped come in as a partner to unlock that potential for us. And there's going to be lots of learning, I think, both directions around that. So that's been a great experience so far. And we've got a couple of live opportunities with different practices that are getting close to turning into real things as well. So that's a really important part of it. I think talking more broadly about architecture, I see a reality in the future where you're going to have lots of really big monster practices and lots of small practices. I think the middle is going to kind of get sort of swallowed up. And the reason I say that is because as this innovation happens, as this evolution of our output through AI and things happen, there's a cost component to this that's going to make it attainable for some people and not for others. And I think that large practices and large entities are going to be the ones that will actually be able to afford that. And they'll race so far ahead that it's not going to really filter down to small practices. So I think it's a really interesting time. And in terms of what that means for the future of DAS, I don't know. I want to do our work nationally, and we do work nationally. I don't know if our trajectory looks like having an office in every state. I think what we've been able to show it with our work and through the modular work is that we can operate and have an impact whilst being largely based in Adelaide with Melbourne as a satellite office. But, you know, we think we've got something to offer, and we're navigating in our minds, how do we best do that? Is it a 20-person practice primarily based out of South Australia, and perhaps being a bit more patient and waiting for those opportunities to present themselves? Or is it a more aggressive strategy? You know, is it actually finding a way to join forces with someone that's completely unexpected in a more permanent kind of way that unlocks what we're trying to achieve. So yeah, interesting times ahead.
And never losing your essence and what's made you yourself as well. And look, I mean, it is very interesting our times ahead. I very much look forward to sort of following that continuous journey. And you've done a great job where you've got to so far. And I have no doubt with your thinking it will continue to grow. Look, thank you so much for sharing all of those amazing insights. I agree with you. I'm not quite sure. I have another take on the AI. I'm sort of noticing that the problem with AI is it's moving so quickly. It's like that or other tech, right? And that sometimes the agility of smaller firms, so we're talking probably mass of 15 plus 20, where you kind of got a little bit of enough, is it depends what that tech is going to be and what it's going to cost. But it's a lot easier to implement that with less people. And I'm actually seeing that it can enable potentially smaller firms to be able to act a lot bigger and compete at a bigger scale. But the interesting thing with architecture is, as you said, there's a bit of that business as usual of, oh, you're that size, you're that brand, you're that part. So I think for your firm, it's interesting that you found a little bit of your piece of difference, but also then partnering with other really well-established and respected firms for what they do and partnering that both of you learn. We obviously did a podcast with BKK on the benefits of JVs and partnerships. And I really do think that is actually the future for a lot of smaller firms. That mid-tier will be interesting, where it's that sort of they're big enough that they may not be able to move quite at the speed of a smaller firms, but also they're not necessarily at that tier one part where they're being invited for certain parts. So, and I think that market is different in each state as well. I think there is a quokal part in Perth and Adelaide and Brisbane and even in Canberra where there is very small degrees of separation that knowing who people are. But I think there is a massive benefit. There is a lot of really well-established, good operating firms who can learn from more emerging firms who are a bit more forward-thinking, who are able to invest the time in that, but also deliver great outcomes. So it'll be interesting. Times ahead. Everybody can speculate, as you said. You just never know where these things are going to end up. And I think the next 5 years is going to be an interesting one. And the next 10 to 20 will be an interesting one too. But look, what I've taken out of our conversation, your story is there's also important skills here in that it is still a people business. It is important to be keeping on top of, particularly if you're emerging in your career, around technology and what you're doing, the value add that you can bring. But I think there's something in here that Jay, you've also talked about that I think a lot of firms, it's always a rat race sometimes, chase a project, get the project, deliver a project. Actually having a little bit of that headspace and allowing your team to have a little bit of that headspace to actually think about these things, whilst it can take away from production now, it could actually save you a lot of time or make things more effective in the future as well, or give you that point of difference. And it sounds like that's something that DAS has done.
We're still finding our way with that. I mean, there is a commercial viability kind of overlay to all this as well in terms of, you know, for Sarah and I, this is very much a project of passion in DAS. And so what success looks like for us is very different to what it might look like for five directors of a practice who have very different objectives and their different parts of their life. So it's a very interesting time for us, particularly around what evolution of leadership looks like as part of that whole story too. So watch this space. Who knows what's going to happen next. We appreciate the opportunity to have a chat about it all.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing your story and all of your insights. I think we could talk for 2 hours. We're already at an hour 15. So look, we'll round up there, Dan. Is there anything that you would tell people, a book, a person, even if it is getting involved in things, a bit of advice for somebody or some resources to go and have a look at?
Yeah, sure. I think, again, I mean, the Institute is that's a passion thing, to be honest. You know, I think in committing and investing in the profession is an important thing. I don't think we can afford to be selfish. Being generous is a key thing of mine. And I think that's an important part of what ultimately will help sustain our profession and our relevance, albeit I think it could be done better, but that's a whole other podcast in itself. I think in terms of some of the, I guess, the books to read and things like that, someone that I've always looked up to is Mariana Mazzucato. She's a Italian thinker, particularly around like foresight and in particular the role of government within the whole ecosystem around innovation. So I think it's called Moonshot, but basically it's a book that frames how the entire country of the US steeled itself around the singular idea of getting a, you know, human or man on the moon, and then what that unlocked and how important government were in that. So, you know, I think that's a really interesting book that speaks to the idea of how you make change at a whole system level as well. And I think, you know, and Shannon, who's just gone on this fellowship, Dan Hill, is someone that we had at one of our events, Future Forum, which is an event series I've been running for 10 years since my fellowship. I think it's, I'm going to stuff up the name of the book, but I'm pretty sure it's about, it's like Dark Matter and Trojan Horses. So it's kind of like this idea around how you can deploy design thinking by stealth. So that's a good read as well.
Amazing. Thank you. We will get those from you at their proper titles and include those in the show notes. Dino, thank you so much for all your time today.
All right. Thank you so much.